Accession number 23153, reel 5.
Catch, Scotty. But it had its good effect.
Yes.
It certainly kept the hands up off the prey, the photographic machines, so on.
Now,
I think I must have told you this, when I was lying on the stretcher, the CO at Basio said, I told you that.
Yes, you told me that, yes, I've heard it down, yes.
But I was glad to hear that, because it is straight from the horse's mouth, so to speak. We used to have an enormous lot of accidents. 24 squadron arrived, not missing.
Now, with these patrols that you had, I mean, how many aircraft took part in patrol normally of the lines?
Four
aircraft. And that was right from the very beginning, you had four aircraft patrol.
Four. As soon as the formation started.
Yes.
That was.
But that was later on in the year, wasn't it? That was in June. But I mean, when you first arrived at Burton.
Oh, it was generally single aircraft.
The same as with the Vickers. Right.
Yes.
Come on. He says, I want to get into this box here.
Well, should we move the box? We'll have a recording.
Good girl. Very brave girl.
That's it.
Now, sit down.
She says, I want your leg.
So there were single aircraft patrols until later on in the year, until the summer, really. So
they were, they'd started by the Somme offensive.
Yes.
A little before that, I think.
So, this business about marking the aircraft, the struts, I think, otherwise we're going to stand
Oh, is this still working?
Yes, it's still working, yes, I'll be recording everything.
Oh, well, she better not get down the stool.
Well, it's okay.
Upset the
no, it's all right, don't worry. Remember this strut marking they had for identification in the air? That probably didn't start until much later on in the year, really, when you had more than one aeroplane flying on a patrol.
Can't remember a thing about that.
No. I've got down.
It's a pity that Watts seems to have died. You say
yes, he was the equipment officer, yes.
He has died, has he?
Yes, that's what I've heard, yes.
Oh. The last time I saw him was at Cologne.
Yes.
He was at that show.
In March 1916, you've got here, you're flying at 11,000 feet on an army patrol. And you've got here, landed near number 11, lost prop.
Lost?
Prop.
Prop.
Yes.
Oh.
Remember that?
No.
And you put after it D-D cold.
D-D?
Yeah, I should imagine you meant damned cold.
I was going to say damned D-D.
I should imagine that's what you meant. Damned cold.
So.
It must have been very cold. You mentioned this cold quite a lot at this period. You mentioned on another patrol a couple of days later.
Was that a DH-2 or
that's
yeah?
DH-2, yes. Patrol. Cold gun jam. And then another little later, you've got freezing cold, eye trouble. Petrol would not shut off. And then here you've got on the 20th of March, you've got engaged LVG. Near Bienville, died 2,000 feet, got bullet through nacelle, destroying Longeron, or Longeron.
Yeah, Longeron.
He fled over lines, fight at 9,000 feet. Do you remember that?
Well, in a faint way, sort of way. Yeah. Nothing particular happened, I don't think.
Just a stray bullet, was that?
Just a stray bullet.
Yeah. I'm just going through various things here, so I've jogged your memory on anything. You did some photographic work as well, apparently, or photographic escort.
Oh, very, very, lot.
Now that was quite a nasty thing, wasn't it? photographic escort in.
Yes, that's where the art is. And they generally fired at us, as far as I could make out. Hanging on behind, you see, and you couldn't get away from them because that's your job, to sit and suffer.
And they were long jobs, were they, the
yes,
escorts?
Quite long.
A long way over?
No, generally over the trenches.
Over the trenches?
Yes.
But what sort of a frontage did you have to cover with that sort of thing? You know, how many miles of front would you cover?
Well,
what,
the whole front was about 20 miles, wasn't it?
Well, the front covered by your squadron?
Yeah, but the whole of the BEF, wasn't it?
Yes, but I mean, but obviously, 24 squadron...
24 squadron had 20 miles.
...had a certain miles, area which it had to look after.
Yes, 20 miles.
20 miles. Mm. So...
To the French?
Yes.
Army, 6th front, I think it was called.
Yes. Because apparently 29 squadron was further north. And there was 32 squadron, DH2s.
Yes.
And obviously they used to look after each section, you know, their own section. And when you do a patrol, you just do a beat up and down between two points.
Yes.
Over the trenches. Or further inland, into the German lines.
Yes.
Now, when you saw the Fokkers at that time, were they flying singly or in groups? Did they tend to stick together in groups as such?
If it was the time before the formation started, they were probably more likely to be in groups then, and not so much when they were single machines. It's rather difficult to recall that.
But most of the aircraft you seem to have met were LVGs and Rolands.
Yes.
And the Roland was a sort of very streamlined-looking aeroplane, wasn't it?
It was what?
A very streamlined. It had a very sort of, it's like a fish shape.
I can't tell you the difference now between a Roland and an LBG. I have the faintest recollection of what they were. There were others besides that.
Yeah, Halberstadt, weren't
there? I think that was later, wasn't it?
Yes, that was a bit later on. But the Fokkers were on their way out, weren't they? I mean, by the summer of 1916, the Fokkers were more or less finished.
Yes, well, they were being harried by that time. They had been.
But the Germans were developing better machines, the Albatross.
Yes.
I mean, which by August, the Albatross made an appearance.
Yes.
I mean, that was probably the sort of aircraft that shot you down.
Yes. I don't know, I can't remember now what machines they were. You see, there were 8 machines originally.
Yes.
When I started to dive, but 3 of them must have had L plates.
Yes.
And delighted I was to see them go. I said, well, I don't know why they're going, but they must have had instructions. If attacked, get away, because they were learners, I should think. I can't think of any other reason.
Now, what happened on your first case of cylindritis?
Oh, then. That I remember pretty well. I was after a German aircraft, and on the wrong side of the lines, from my point of view, when, without any warning, as generally happened in that case, 2 cylinders started to emerge together. Not one, but 2. Two neighboring cylinders.
Yeah.
And as far as I can remember, it was the piston of one cylinder tried to get into the cylinder of the other or something like that, and they jammed each other with the most unpleasant sensation for me. This machine nearly turned over on its back, so to speak. I was not very far from the trenches at the time, and I forgot all about the enemy machine. I was no longer interested in him. I had only one thing to do. I had no engine, you see. I had to get to the other side of the lines or I was a prisoner. So I must save up, get the gliding angle at the slowest possible. Now this gave the Germans on the ground plenty of time to have pots at me wondering what on earth I was doing. All I was doing was, I was very low down, I wanted to get over all the trenches intact. And then, as it happened, although they did fire everything they had at me, and they apparently never hit me, hit any part of the machine. And I seeing a piece of green grass on our side of the lines, and I just managed to make it. It was the balloon section. One of our balloon sections. In fact, when I got out and looked at the engine, this is what I saw, these two juxtaposition cylinders like that. I rang up the squadron.
Was that the time that, I remember before you telling me that you landed like in a clearing?
Yes.
And there was nobody else around, it was quiet. Was that the time, was it this time this happened? And you said there was nobody about, because normally as soon as you come down you get a crowd of
This is at the front, you see.
Yes.
Just over the trenches.
Yes. Oh, I see.
Oh, yes. This is a very different story.
Yes.
And there were, I don't know about a crowd, there were several balloon section people about to help. And the officer in charge said, it just happens that Basil Hallam, the actor,
yes,
was a very popular man. Things like, Gilbert the Filbert. That's his song.
That's his song, yes.
But what was it called? The Passing Show or something?
Yes, something.
And there was that girl,
Elsie Janis,
who he was fond of. I learned that again later, yes, because he said he's in Paris at this moment.
Who said that? An officer in the balloon section.
Balloon section, yes. He got a very nice cabin, I think they called it. I suppose it's Nissen Hut, I think.
Yes.
Anyway, he said, you can have this, but he won't be back till tomorrow late.
Basil Hallam's bed.
Yeah.
That isn't his real name, of course. It's
that was his stage name, was it?
Stage name, yes. And there was a large picture of
Elsie Janis
by the side of his bed on his occasional table.
So what happened after that? I telephoned
the squadron. They said that they'd be sending along next day an engine repair outfit and so on, you see. And I, when that had been put in, I just flew away. That was the end of that. Back to the squadron.
Now, when you were the flight commander, or B flight, did you have a lot of office work to do,
Very little, if any.
Because later on, there was a lot more office work to do, wasn't there, as a flight commander?
I dare say, but I didn't certainly have any.
Not so much during the war, I should think, more in peacetime than there were.
Office work,
yeah.
Not during the war.
I don't know, they had records to keep all the time.
Every now and again, when Hawker was on leave or had to go away somewhere. Anyhow, I was commanding the squadron, you see. And there was very little office work there, too.
So Hawker must have been a little bit bored, sitting around.
I was able to do my own turns, early morning flying, for instance. When he was away for, say, a couple of weeks or something like that.
And do you think there was much sort of drinking going on at that time in the mess?
Not that I ever saw, no.
Did you had a proper organised mess there, did you, with a bar?
Oh, yes.
And they can produce meals and things like that.
If it is a pouring wet day, yes. Poker must generally be the thing that we play.
Yeah.
It was expensive as far as I was concerned, because I always lost as far as I remember.
Time you had
synodritis,
which I think was a lot more formidable.
Yes, it was. Yes, in between there had been two or three of those sort of actions. I think the most amazing, one was Sibley's effort,
yes.
Which is recounted, I think, in Holger.
Well, they got the shells with the nose.
Well, he landed in a tree or something and undressed himself.
Oh, that's right. Yes, I remember that was synodritis.
Yes, I believe so.
Why did he undress himself?
I don't know. I don't suppose he does.
No. Oh, he was a bit...
He's got concussed.
Yes, but he didn't know what he was doing.
Well, if he landed in a tree with a DH2, it must have been... I don't know how he got out of it, but he did. But the others got killed. Most of them.
What happened to you?
17th of June, I think it was. But this is all in Hawkers.
I know, but I want to hear it from you first.
Oh.
What, the day you shut down?
No. Just before
that. When the cylinder blew out, it made that propeller that we've been talking about. Hawker had fixed... made a plan with the troops at various points for them to put out arrows, white arrows, to show you in the direction the enemy were in as you fly. And he'd get telephones and say, there's a machine now leaving so-and-so and going in this direction. And your job was to be in the DH2 in about 2 minutes. Whoever was on duty for that particular kind of work. And this was the case on the 17th of June. I was on patrol, on duty. And when the bell, an old cylinder knocking, was used to be used, I think, shouted to me that time to be off, it was a matter of 2 or 3 minutes, and I was sailing away to go in the direction I'd been told.
But these arrows, they run in the front lines, were they?
They were scattered about the place.
And they were pointing to the direction of the enemy aircraft?
Yes. But it never got that far as I was concerned, that particular day. I'd got to 4,000 feet, about 10 miles from Bertheim, I suppose. No warning. Bang! You see? And at that time, my ears were always pinned back, listening to the engine behind me for any tricks it wanted to do. And at the same moment, that bang was the... I noticed afterwards that although I wasn't aware of it at the time, I'd already switched off everything.
So you must have heard something.
Automatically it happened. You see, your hands moved like that.
Yes.
And I was surprised to see how quickly I'd done it.
Yes.
Just as well, too, because one cylinder had left. The flames, I suppose, were shooting out into anywhere they wanted to go. It took off the one blade of a four-blader propeller. It went through the top main spar, leaving a gap of about 6 inches, and the whole top wing fell about 6 inches or so. The shaking, owing to the propeller still moving, whizzing round, was terrific. It caused all the ammunition runs to leave their sockets and so on, and they did more damage going through, knocking holes through the wings and so on. And then I noticed that one of the main supports struck and broken in half like that behind my back, And I saw below me, it was a beautiful June day, and I saw below me, in a wood, a nice big field. And I thought, that's about where I should try and land.
You were always but, right way up all the time, were you?
Oh yes, right way up, but it was, I think I was more frightened then than I've ever been in my life, as a matter of fact. Because...
What about the controls? Could you steer?
The controls were in a very poor way indeed. That was one of my troubles. Owing to the struts on which the controls were going back to the back of the machine, both sides, had simply slopped out of its position as a strut altogether. As a result, the controls were all over the place. To get any movement at all, I had to swing the compass instead of being like this.
Yeah.
But eventually, I made a good landing. The undercarriage was the only part of the machine that wasn't serviceable. That was serviceable.
Was serviceable. Yeah.
But so it was written off as it stood.
So you didn't nose over at all? You were upright?
Yes, didn't roll over. Oh no, it was a good landing. But I was so shaken that I stood on my seat with my arms over the top wing, what there was of it. I should think for 20 minutes, just recovering myself and saying, you're still here. Before I found a farmhouse to get, or something, where I could get a telephone.
It must have seemed very unreal, actually, the whole thing.
Yes.
You'd have landed like that.
Yeah. I was certainly extremely lucky.
Yeah.
Right. Still operating. And that was about, do you remember, I think it was Sibley, the chap who got the shell through the nose of DH2?
No, it was Tidmarsh.
Tidmarsh, yes.
Because he was using my machine at that moment.
That's right. That was the one with the gun mounted off to one side.
Yes,
you
I suppose
you, you had a windscreen, but you said you can't remember anything about that.
All I know about that is what Tidmarsh has written, I think.
Yeah.
I wrote
he said that his was on the left. You see, your machine had it on the right.
Ah.
Yeah, you see. But,
that's my impression. It was the central machine, central gun was there,
yeah.
And in between that and the end of the machine, there was the other one.
Yeah.
And they were wired up in some way that you could fire both together.
And I believe that the machine gun that was mounted to one side was still inboard of the Longeron. It wasn't outside the aircraft. They were yoked together.
Yeah.
Like they were later on the shaft mounting of the... two-seaters.
At the time, yeah, when they were being used, everybody had his own ideas as to how to put them and yeah, how to fix them.
But you say this was quite a common thing, that quite a number of the pilots had these.
All the lot, I think.
Yes.
The whole crowd. Yes, because the people that had two guns originally, they said, well, it's marvellous.
Yeah.
We lose about 200 or 300 feet of height by putting in another gun. But the comfort of having two guns compared to one gun is colossal.
Yes.
And you feel quite naked going up with one gun.
Yes.
And that is the precise time when some staff officer came along who didn't know anything about flying or anything else, I don't think. But he'd been ordered to stop this nonsense, you see, as they thought of it.
Now, normally, when you fire the gun...
When you come to think of it, today, it's an 8-gun fighter or something
yes,
like that.
Yes, yes. Well, you
and
fire
two
about 50 rockets. Or
and two guns.
But that's the sort of washing out something that was helping the pilots to defend themselves.
Not only that, but to shoot down
but if that
something
wasn't
else.
Important.
Well, it's against regulations, wasn't it?
Yes, it is against regulations. Yeah.
But
there shouldn't be such regulations.
What has always puzzled me about
it's the man that's on the gun that ought to be asked.
Yes.
But what's puzzled me about this business is that how did you sight the gun, the two guns, you see? Because there were no tracer bullets, were there, in those days?
Yes, they were.
When did they come in, of course?
I think in 15.
Did they? Mm-hmm. You had them in the Vickers, did you?
I think so. We certainly had them in 16, but I don't think they were any use.
No.
They appeared to be shooting into the other machine, but it was an illusion, I think.
Yes. But
the bullet went one way and the tracer showed the other.
But you had sights on the DH-2. Now, when you attacked an aircraft, did you actually use sights or did you just point the aircraft in the general direction and just fire?
That's it. Pretty well, that's what I
did. You didn't sort of line it up on the sights, waiting very carefully.
No. There wasn't time for all that kind of thing.
No, because, I mean, McCudden worked like this.
Yeah, he did.
McCudden used to creep up on aircraft and get underneath them, and then turn his nose up or pull the Lewis gun down, fire up carefully.
That was on an SE, I think.
That was on an SE, yes.
We hadn't any refinements on a DH-2 right then.
So, really, there wasn't much finesse in the sort of the way you fought as such. Deflection fire and things like that.
The only time I think I remember using... I was shouting at Lane, I think, when the two tails went past. I said, fire right ahead of the whole machine's length, ahead of the... Let him walk into it.
Yes.
That's sort of my idea, but I don't know... Whether it did any good.
Hawk was working on something, wasn't he?
What I don't remember is what Hawker's reaction were when the chap came along. He wasn't there on that day, I don't think. But it didn't seem to worry him much. I don't remember him. He was very inclined to believe that the gods above were marvellous, I think.
Yes, so I mean, he did what he was told. I mean, he wouldn't stand up and say, look, I think two guns are better, regardless of what the brass had to say.
Yes. Whether he did or not, I don't know, but there was no result anyway. No. We didn't have, the two guns went forever at that time.
Yeah.
But the next year, of course, they had two gun everything else. Two gun, or three guns, or whatever it was. Certainly the Camel had two guns.
Yes. Now, I think you had the Fokker fairly well beaten, didn't you, with the DH-2? I mean, it was a good match for the Fokker.
Yes, it certainly seems to be.
I mean, it was more manoeuvrable than the Fokker, was it?
The DH-2 was manoeuvrable, of course.
Yes.
It was very manoeuvrable.
Because I believe that the sort of...
Only trouble was it was too slow.
Yes.
It lost its machines like that. They dive away and you couldn't catch them up.
Now, I think the most busy period in the Cross Squadron seems to have been July of 1916. I mean, with the sort of, well, actually before that, I mean, probably building up to the Battle of the Somme. Yeah. I should imagine that you had quite a lot of work to do at that time, did you?
A lot, yes. It was 3 or 4 patrols a day, which is a lot. About 1.5 hours each.
Now, I suppose the idea of that was to stop German aircraft from prying and photographing the back areas to see the massing of the troops and the equipment.
Yes.
And so on.
Yes.
Now, I believe in your...
You recognise my voice?
Yes, it's pretty good, I think.
Yeah.
Fairly like you.
In your logbook, you mentioned that, I think, in June, I think...
If I'd known that you were going to come along 55 years later, about my logbooks, I might have done something rather better than
that. <Yes. laughs>
They were just scribbled in any old time.
I think there's a lot of information there, actually.
Do you really?
Yes, there's a lot of information.
What have you got, his logbooks?
I've made a copy of it, photographed
them all. See?
Good gracious.
In June, towards the end of June, I think 6 days before the Somme, you mentioned that you saw the shelling commence at the Battle of the Somme.
Yes,
of
course, it was going on for a whole week.
Yeah.
Just like the beating of carpets.
Yeah.
That's what it sounded like at Bertha.
Yeah. Yes, and then that was all the time for 6 days.
Perpetual beating of carpets.
Yes.
It was the biggest bombardment the world has ever seen, I suppose.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, they had a whole lot of Dutch shells at that time.
Yes, and falling short, I suppose.
And when they thought they'd disappointed all the enemy wire, they had.